Willkommen beim Wanderful Podcast, Yoga Beyond the Asana. Ich bin Wanda Badwal. Ich freue mich, gemeinsam mit dir die faszinierende Welt des Yoga, der Spiritualität und persönlichen Weiterentwicklung zu entdecken, zu hören und zu erfahren, wie wir mehr Liebe, Balance und Erfüllung in unserem täglichen Leben integrieren können. Schön, dass du hier bist. Hi, and welcome to the wonderful podcast, Yoga Beyond the Asana. I'm very happy that you're here. Today, I am very excited. I have a very special guest. It's Sentatsu Beka Roshi. So I have the honor to be speaking today with a Zen master. I have a special personal relationship with him. My parents are long-term students of him, and I know him since I was a little child playing next to the meditation ground, meditation retreats. But for the ones of you who don't know him yet, here is an official introduction of Beka Roshi. Sentatsu Beka Roshi is the founder and head teacher of Dharma Sangha centers in the United States and Europe. In the United States, he lives at Creston Mountain Zen Center in Colorado, and in Germany at the Zen Buddhist Zentrum Schwarzwald in the Black Forest, Germany. He has been teaching Zen Buddhism for 45 years. From January through May, he lives and teaches in the USA, and from May through December, he lives and teaches in Europe. At present, he gives online lectures every Sunday and afternoon, which are open to anyone who's interested. He is the Dharma successor of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the first Zen master to establish residential and monastic practice for lay people and monks in the West. Suzuki Roshi is also the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. In 1966, with and for Suzuki Roshi, Beka Roshi co-founded Tassajara Zen Mountain Center in California, the first traditional Zen monastery outside of Asia. Welcome, Richard Beka Roshi. Thank you so much for taking the time for this interview and to be here with us.
You're welcome. And I've been teaching for 60 years, not 45 years.
We have to correct that in your CV.
Well, yeah, must be an old one.
So I would love to ask you a little bit about your path to Zen and your path to the inner world. When did it start? And maybe you can, bring us a little bit along in your history.
Okay. Well, I suppose since we have this terrible Ukrainian-Russian war going on right now, my own decision to that I had to do something other than be other than accepting the culture that I grew up in America, because this was a culture that was willing to make war and very intelligent scientists to build nuclear weapons. So I was pretty much the first generation of, at 5 or 6 years old starting, of being in a war that was on the radio. And I couldn't believe, really, it didn't make sense, nobody, what anybody said, why Americans were killing Germans and Germans were killing Americans and Italians and so forth. And particularly since most of my neighbors in the Midwest at the time were of German background. So I couldn't accept it. So I made a basic kind of decision to not participate in our society in any way that supported the ongoing acceptance of war, and which is, legalized killing. So I, at some point in high school, after high school, discovered Buddhism. At least it was a teaching. I explored a lot of different teachings and beliefs, and I definitely, since I'm from a scientific family and background, and transcendental family in New England, Emerson and so forth, Thoreau. I really didn't want to follow anything rooted in belief. So my emphasis has been, and my emphasis in practicing Buddhism and Zen has been in looking at to live as closely as possible to how we actually exist, not how we want to exist or how our culture tells us we exist. So anyways, so that led me to exploring a lot of things, philosophy and science and things, and I ended up thinking the closest thing I know is to an acceptable way of defining the world and experiencing the world was Buddhism.
Hmm. And can you speak a little bit about what Zen Buddhism means to you? Or the definition of it?
Yeah, well, if we go back to the 25 centuries ago, which really isn't that long, I mean, I've lived almost a century now, and 25 of those, plus 15 years in each century, would get you back to Buddha's time. He was born into a shamanic culture, which was really kind of divided loosely into the survivors, who were merchants, farmers, and so forth, and the seekers. Shramana means seekers. And so Buddha was the first, the historical Buddha, and he was a historical person. It's not a revealed religion. It's a historical person trying to make sense of existence. Yogic culture is not a culture where there's a God space or a creator. So it's basically a kind of phenomenology, a kind of with a different kind of depth than Western phenomenology. And so the Buddha was not only was one of the leading seekers of the time, he also decided that what he had discovered, the transformative practice he had discovered, basically that there's a plasticity or elasticity to our mind, body, and neurology and all, and it can be transformed by wisdom or by meditation or by just how we view ourselves. So he decided that, hey, this teaching I've worked out is a teaching for everybody, anybody. So he became the first world teacher, and Buddhism is the first world teaching. Then there's Christianity and Islam and Abrahamic religions, and there's science, which is a world teaching. But Buddhism was the first world teaching in the sense that, hey, maybe this is the way we all should live. And the way we all should live is really simply rooted in there must be a way to get along with each other. And right now, we're not getting along with each other. Look at what's happening in Europe. Let's hope it's the last territorial war. And it's a war happening on the internet and in an immediacy that my radioed war was not. So it's a different ball game, hopefully a better ball game if we have time to enough of us to survive climate change. Mm-hmm. So I basically decided I've got to find a way to get along with myself, get along with the environment I live in, and get along with others.
You were speaking about the crisis we have right now in the world, the war against Mother Earth, the war happening in Europe right now. Do you have any wisdom, or what would be useful, helpful for each individual to know or to do right now?
Well, I think how we experience the world is killing the world, and or how we live on the planet, how we live our life is killing the, and that's rooted in our experience. So if we're going to do something about it individually, it's, you can't really recommend it to others or imagine it as a teaching or a practice for others unless you do it yourself, can do it yourself. And so we need a door. And in English, a useful door, a door that you can keep opening, because, you know, we're so acculturated. You know, one of the things that we, you can observe about worldviews is most worldviews don't include much of the world. They exclude a lot of the world in establishing their own worldview. So we need to, so once you're acculturated, it's really in your, it's not just ideas, it's really in your nervous system, in your neurology, in your, in the, in how, and what you take for granted. So I think that what one thing we, one door in English to explore is, this sounds pretty simplistic, but it is simple. Explore the difference between whatness and who-ness, or the word what and who. In English, they're just two short words, both starting with W, but they make a difference. If you say to yourself right now, what am I? Well, you feel that question penetrates you in a certain way. If you're an English speaker, and probably even if you're German, or if you say, who am I? Well, that's a whole different ballgame. Who am I? No, but what am I? So I, my own suggestion is that you try out for a month or two or a lifetime, looking at the whatness of things and not the who-ness of things. And that really requires a kind of practical discipline that daily meditation helps you do, et cetera, have, is you, everything you look at, you see and feel the whatness. So say I'm walking along the street. My reference point is, what am I? How I'm breathing, my exhale, my inhales, how my feet are on the sidewalk or wherever. And I'm not much thinking about who I am. And when I see another person, I notice the whatness of them. When I see the sidewalk or the automobiles on the street or whatever, I notice the whatness of them. And you know, we are, unless you want to live in an imagined God space, we are the same stuff as the car and the sidewalk, et cetera, just a different combination, which gives us, allows us to have sentience. But the distinction between who and what's not who is destroying the world. What's sentient and not sentient is a earthworm or a bat, as there's a famous book about that, or a dragonfly, or a, my fingernails are not very different from the wood here and the glass of this window behind me. It's all a different combination of whatness, which in our case has sentience. But it takes some time to, and this door of whatness instead of who-ness takes some time to really get into your system, so you feel you're in the midst of whatness all the time. And the result of that, just try it out for a few hours or a few days or whatever, the result of that is you begin to feel a connectedness with everything. And believe it or not, it's one of the doors to freeing yourself from suffering.
Yeah, thank you for this very practical exercise we can take into our daily lives to experience Zen. So looking for the who might lead us to think about ourselves as something separate from others or something special. We also like to call the ego, right? So what would you say is the function of the ego when it leads to so much destruction? Like, why did we humans get something as such, as a who-ness?
I don't think we can ask the question why, because that implies a creator who made a decision, you should or shouldn't have. So, but you can say we do have this sense of consciousness and a sense of subjectivity that this is me. I mean, I'm, as I said, 86 years old, but basically I feel like a 20-year-old with something wrong with him. Or my balance is not as good as it was, but basically I feel the same way I did. So there's some continuity of the subjective who-ness, the experience of being a particular person. Well, that experience of being a particular person, if it is confined to it's really hard to answer, to find ways to speak about it in any Western language. But the sense of your connectedness, the more it's distributed, let's say in this case, in this short time we have together, if it's distributed in the feeling of a shared whatness, it doesn't function anymore more like an ego. You're in a context, and the context is always part of what you're doing. You're not separate from the context. As long as you think you're separate from the context or feel you're separate from the context, and you're walking along in the context and hardly paying any attention to the context, then it's very easy for that sense of who-ness to get into a comparison with others' who-ness and et cetera. So really, if I take the precepts or I decide, for instance, Buddhism is basically rooted in what I call the four tenets. One is that transformation is possible. If you don't think transformation is possible, if you think you have a fixed identity, then you're not going to be able to practice, really. You have to understand, accept, and imagine that transformation is possible. Then when transformation happens in tiny little ways, the way you walk down the street, or something, that you will notice that hey, it's a little different today. If you don't notice those differences, you're not a seeker. So the first tenet is, you have to really believe that transformation, realization, enlightenment is possible. And then it's really necessary to know also that it's possible to be free of emotional and psychological suffering. Again, if you don't really know it's possible, you'll just suffer and not sort of see the mosaic, the tapestry of suffering, where you can begin to feel, because there's sometimes you suffer more, sometimes you suffer less. You really want to feel the landscape of suffering. And if you can't enter the landscape, the landscape is just going to fall on top of you. Okay, and the third is you want to live as close as possible to how things actually exist. Now that can mean almost anything, but your sense noticing when you're functioning from belief or the way you want it to be, or functioning from just noticing and accepting. Unless you again practice transforming your habits through like noticing and accepting, eventually you begin to accept more and more, notice, and you're in the midst of context, what you're informing you. You're not being informed just by what you like and don't like. What you like and don't like just reinforce the narrow surviving brain consciousness, which for us in Abrahamic cultures is rooted in the sense of preferential self. So that's the third, is to practice or find a way to get closer to how we actually exist, which is to undo the beliefs and comparisons we have, etc. Okay, and the fourth is it is possible to live in a way that's beneficial to others and beneficial to the planet. Again, if you don't know that, then you don't notice when what you're doing is not beneficial. So these four tenets are part of the attitudes you bring to your daily mentality, your daily movements, your daily activity, and it begins to transform you. It transforms you neurologically. I mean, a person who sits regularly, which is really a way of developing stillness. And if you develop stillness, you can begin to practice attentionality. And so again, to change it, pushing the topic a little, our culture is rooted in conceptuality. Yogic culture is rooted in attentionality. This actually makes a big difference. Like we want to know what we're conscious of and be able to act on what we're conscious of. But in a culture which is attentional, you begin to recognize that the context and, for example, Tim Morton, who came up with the concept of hyperobjects as climate change, the hyperobject, says, where do the genes of a beaver end? Does the genes of a beaver end at his whiskers or her whiskers? Or do they end at the dam? Well, the dam is part of the genes of a beaver. So we are in a context when your emphasis is self, ego, etc., and the identity stream, a constant identity stream where you're checking up on yourself, your genes are thwarted from being part of the actual context in which at every moment you're breathing and living and so forth. So yeah, that was a little bit of a riff.
Thank you for the riff. Yeah, there was a lot in it. So you were speaking about the four tenets. I will definitely, you know, put a link so people can read them and, you know, maybe integrate them into their daily lives. Super, yeah, very, very helpful hints but rules to live after. Let's go a little bit further. You said enlightenment is possible. That's a good message. So in yoga, we call it also, you know, waking up, moksha, freedom from suffering, samadhi, the state of oneness. So I've been lately contemplating a lot about enlightenment. also,
well, you named your kid enlightenment, so you know you better pay attention to it.
I mean, you know, and what like really moves me around this topic is that, you know, this so-called enlightenment people or masters, you know, also seem to be very human. And so for me, what really is a question is like, from your perspective, how does enlightenment look like in a human form? Or yeah, like how would you define that?
Well, enlightenment, it's kind of a confusing word in English. I don't know what word is in German, but it's pretty common. Fishermen, farmers, all kinds of people are enlightened. And Buddhism emphasizes a certain kind of enlightenment. Enlightenment, basically, an experience of enlightenment is a change that happens to you that gives you some kind of freedom or openness that remains. It doesn't go away. So there are experiences where you have an experience of oneness, which I wouldn't use the word oneness because that is a theological idea, that there's some kind of theistic oneness. But there's, maybe I would use the word allness. So you can have the experience of oneness or allness, and you can project that onto the world, and it may be true, but at least you can have an experience of allness and of connectedness, and we can call that an, if you want, we want a realization experience or a enlightenment experience, and it depends on. In a Buddhist sense, it depends on, well, let me say again, you know, one is an experience that frees you from categories. Now, it may only free you from some categories, but the, a very a deep experience of enlightenment, which affects your whole life, is you no longer think in categories or feel in categories. Every moment is, I mean, you realize that it's all a construct. You're a construct. The world is a construct. And you can participate in the categories of the construct, but you see them as a construction. So you're just living in a construction right now. I'm constructing things. I'm in this room I've constructed. You're sitting there in the room you've constructed. And none of it's permanent. It's all impermanent. And so we're in the midst of a flow of connectedness. You're not in a reality, you're in a relationality. And so if you can just shift to seeing everything as a relationality, or there are no entities, there's only activities. And activities, if this watch of mine here, which I put down here, is an activity. The glasses are an activity. The book is an activity. It's an activity because it's just sitting on top of some other books. So gravity requires it to sit on this or it'll fall down, you know. So everything, and I can pick it up, it's an activity. Someone wrote it. And even a stone, if you look at a stone geologically, you can see the stone is an activity. It's been around a million years or hundreds of thousands of years, you can see the activity in the stone. So the more you can shift to feeling everything is an activity, space is an activity. I mean, we have the idea in the West that Newtonian space is a container we're living in. You're not living in a container. You're living in a kind of field of connectedness in which space allows the connectedness and space itself is part of the connectedness. So it's almost like if you lived underwater, you could feel that the water was connectedness. But in here, we don't feel air is connectedness, but in actual experience, you are making, when I lean forward toward you, I'm changing the space that relates us, even when on a screen. So the more you can find yourself in the middle of activity all the time and not entities, it begins to change, again, how you identify with yourself or your ego. Yeah. So that's another little riff.
Hmm. Yeah, it's all deep stuff. And I'm feeling myself like drifting into that like connectiveness space. So yeah, well,
you're speaking to me because you feel some connectedness with me from childhood.
That's true.
Right. Well, so that connectedness has, it results in things. It has a kind of agency. Mm. It itself, you know, the example I use quite often, and though I don't know it's useful in a podcast like this, is the difference between the game of Go and the game of chess. Yoga culture is rooted in contextuality. Western culture is rooted in identity. Now, if you play chess, there's the king and the queen and the pawn and the rook and the, you know, et cetera. And they're each an identity and they bring power to the game. In Go, which is a game that goes back to the Buddhist time in China, and Go is, you just have what are called stones, black and white pieces. They have no power in themselves. They're just black and white stones. But the board empowers them. So the power comes from the context of the board and where you place them on the board. They have no power on their own until you put them in a context. And that was considered from ancient times in China. Intelligent people practiced Go in order to learn about how the world is. Now, unfortunately, I think many Western Buddhists are trying to play chess on a chessboard or trying to play chess on a Go board. And it doesn't work. Chess doesn't work on a Go board. So what I'm always trying to do, if I have a conversation with anybody that maybe it'll make a difference, I try to give them a sense of practice and realization function in a different world than our usual way of thinking. And it functions in a world in which the context is empowering. So, and breathing is part of your context. Walking on the street is part of your context, etc. So you, so the whatness, eventually you can explore who-ness, but first it's good to really get yourself located in whatness, or we say in thusness, but thusness, I don't know how much I can say here. I'll stop in a moment unless you want me to. Thusness not only means that you feel the activity of everything, it also means that you experience the mind as the field of mind and not the contents of mind. So to begin to be able to experience mind as a field in which there can be contents or there doesn't have to be contents, but that's developed through meditation. You eventually in stillness begin to feel like, oh, I can bring that content in or I can take that content out, but I feel the field of mind. I experience that directly, and that's also called thusness. So if you're walking on the street, you're walking in the field of mind in which things are appearing. Okay?
Okay.
It's all doable because we are capable of transformation. And it's doable fairly simply through intention and repetition. Mm-hmm.
Can we speak a little bit about, you know, you mentioned the who-ness, and then it's also, you know, in parts probably important to explore and to work with our who-ness. Can you speak a little bit about what is the meaning to you or for the historical conditions we have, childhood experiences, traumas, and all that, you know, informs and defines who or how we are acting today, the beliefs, the patterns, mind patterns. So can you speak about, from your view, about the importance of working with our historical conditions, childhood traumas, all of that?
Well, Yuval Harari, if you've read him at all, the Israeli, his two or three books, Sapiens and others, are quite good on how we humans are benighted believers of belief. In other words, we tend to want explanations. We make an explanation, and then we're very quick to believe it. We're herding animals. You can't, as people say, you can't herd cats. Not so easy. But armies would not be possible unless you could herd people. You wouldn't get people willing to go up and get killed just because everybody says, go up there, they're going to shoot at you. I mean, That's a herding instinct. So we, as herdable Homo sapiens, once a belief system starts, you get everybody to share the belief, and then you can start controlling the society, controlling the herd of humans. And it's unbelievable that, well, we're not a very old civilization or society, but most of the world is rooted in belief. And luckily, I mean, the great contribution of science is, I think, that it shows us that there's an alternative to belief. I mean, it's just crazy, you know. If you look at European history, the wars and killing and suffering and all that's happened, and in Asia too, through belief. So the only thing we can do, and what Buddhism says to do, is free yourself from belief. But there has to be someone who decides to free themselves from belief. So that someone who is an experience of subjectivity, but an inclusive subjectivity, not an isolated subjectivity. Okay.
Okay.
Every day I'm trying to figure these things out, and I'm trying to figure out ways to talk about it so I can share it. But it's not so easy. Because English, I mean, when you say it rains, right? Mm-hmm. It just rains rain. It doesn't have to have an it that rains. It that rains is a theological idea. There's a God behind it. I remember my daughter, one of my daughters, I said, is it raining out? And she said, yes, it's raining. And I said, would you go out and find the it for me? And Anna, don't be so zen. It's built into our language that somehow we're in a world that's been created and was here before us. No, the world is here in the midst of us right now. And it's gone in the past, and it's not yet here in the future, and we're supporting it as it exists right now. But it's a construct, and we're constructing it. And so it's, once a belief system gets built into a language or a culture, it's really hard to change it. It took 10 centuries for Buddhism to start speaking Chinese and Chinese to speak Buddhism. And they had kind of think tanks, like what's the research think tanks in Germany, named after a scientist. Anyway, I can't think of the name right now. Anyway, they had the equivalent of think tanks that lasted 200 years of people trying to find language, trying to find ways to talk about these things, because it's very difficult to get a culture rooted in belief to start thinking and functioning outside of that belief. So I don't know if we have time. The climate change is, upon us.
Yes, it's upon us. So, question towards the future, what would you recommend for young people, our children, on how to prepare for that future?
The first is to really know it is not only going to happen, it's already happening. When I used to drive in Germany or drive in New Mexico and Colorado, my windshield was covered with insects that kept running into it. So my windshield was an insect collector. Now, the last 4 or 5 years, no insects on my windshield. That means billions of insects don't. It used to be I kind of bow every time I hit an insect. which I kind of drive and bowing all the time. Now I don't bow at all because there's rarely even one insect hits my windshield in places that used to swarm with insects. Well, this is very, very serious, but most people don't. They still gasoline in the car, but the insects not on the windshield are more important than the gasoline in the car. But most people can't think that way. So my daughter, I have three daughters. You don't know the youngest, who's 21 and just is about to graduate in November from UC Berkeley. And she's studying environmental science, cognitive science, physics, etc. But her intention is to see what she can do about the environmental crisis and preparing herself to do that. And I don't know what else to do, because my own opinion is some human beings will survive. Maybe the city of Paris in 1400 will survive, or some number. But there's going to be political chaos like no one's ever seen before, in my opinion. Once things really, you have huge numbers of people finding they can't live here, they can't live there, they're going to go. I mean, you know, it's happened in the past versions of it. And I don't have much hope. In fact, I'm completely pessimistic and completely optimistic, because I rather enjoy optimism. But in fact, it's pretty bad, and it's already happening. And our institutions are you and I can recognize it, but our institutions are not recognizing it. Our governments are. In any effective way. The change required is too big for people located in their own belief system, in their needs, and you have to pay the rent, and you have to have food, and you've got, you know, friends, and that people just don't change that. I don't change that, you know. I mean, I've tried to live without having to have money, and I've tried to live like a monk. So I have no retirement fund, no health insurance, et cetera. And I don't think I'd recommend that to my daughters, though. And I've been lucky enough to be able to manage without having the usual. I mean, I walked out of college because I didn't want to start from a college degree. I wanted to start from scratch. So, but most people wouldn't do that, and there's nowhere they should. And not right now. I think I shouldn't. I'm 86, and I have maybe a few hundred dollars in the bank. That's it. So I wouldn't recommend that to anybody particularly, but I have other resources, people who help me. So
from your very optimistic side, what would you like practically, you know, what each individual who-ness, you know, can do on a daily basis to contribute? You know, I think you said already a few things, but maybe you can, you know, wrap them together again for us. Maybe meditate, maybe do no harm.
Well, it does help to meditate, mainly to develop the stillness, which allows the development of attentionality. And attentionality is to know the world and absorb the world through being attentive to the world and not thinking the world. I think the first step is to really know and notice that it is happening, and be ready to do, when an opportunity appears, be open to those opportunities to do something. Like right now, there was a mask that's been lying on the street near my apartment for several days. So I went down, I picked it up, and I picked up some broken glass and stuff like that. Those are just little things you can do. But it's been there for days. I kept thinking, isn't there a street cleaner or somebody? No. So I've, you know. So I'm optimistic because life in the end is momentary. So for me, each moment is, I'm fine. You know, at each moment, I'm quite happy and everything's fine. So in that sense, I'm optimistic and I will continue that as long as I live. And what can be done about this societal problems? I'm saying things right now, that's something. But I think mainly the thing is to know it and wait and be open to opportunities to do something. And I'm also optimistic because it's the best way to approach huge problems. And in Ukraine, the Russian soldiers are pretty pessimistic and the Ukrainian soldiers are pretty optimistic. Given horrible circumstances, it makes a difference. So I think facing huge problems, optimism is helpful. And also human beings, when they're pressed, when they're really, you know, here's this guy, you may have read in the movie, his arm got cut, falling between two rocks when he was mountain climbing.
Yeah.
And at some point he cut his arm off. It took him several days to do it. But we humans, if we're in a corner, we can behave very badly or we can behave very creatively. And so maybe we'll be in enough of a realization of an experience of what's happening that we'll do something creative. So in that sense, I'm optimistic too. But basically, my optimism is just it's the best way to live.
Thank you so much. So I think there are, you know, we could continue our conversation for a very long time.
Yes.
Yes.
Wouldn't be entirely bad. It's nice to talk with you.
Yeah, with you too. I would love to continue our conversation, but I think we do that in another take.
We have to stop sometime. You're right.
We have to stop sometime. So, last question before the last question. So, if today would be your last day, and you have the opportunity to give a speech in front of humanity, and you can say something, like, would there be anything else you would say to humanity?
Take it easy. Really. I mean, at this moment, I know, and I've already, I don't know if humanity is interested in what I just said, but I've just given a talk through you to at least a few people. And I don't have any special wisdom in other words, just take care of your life with attention.
Thank you so much. So for people who would love to listen more to you, who would love to get into Zen meditation, who feel enchanted, where can they find your teachings? Where can they practice with you? Maybe you can say a few words about your Sangha.
Well, I mean, we call it Dharma Sangha. Dharma means the truth, and Sangha means those who practice the truth. We call it Dharma Sangha, a Sangha for seekers. But I think the simplest these days, the phone book these days is the internet. So dharmasangha-de is Europe. And Dharma Sangha USA will work, or Crestone Mountain Zen Center in America works. Anyway, there either website and allows you to enter the other website, and it just tells you what the program is or where the schedule is, or if you want to come and visit or have a retreat in a cabin for a while or a room, you know, all those alternatives are there, so you can have a way to step out of your usual life for a little while.
Yeah. So people can just also do their personal retreat, right?
Yeah, they can do a personal retreat at our two centers, or they can join in the schedule that we have of regular meditation, etc.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to you and your partner and your baby Bodhi coming and visiting sometime. We'll have a room for you.
That's so lovely. Thank you for the invite. We will come for sure. Yeah, it's a while. I've been there.
Bring your mother and father.
Yes, I will. Yeah, it's been a while. I've been there in the Schwarzwald. Yeah, I will put all the information also down in the show notes so people can find the Zen Center in Schwarzwald, Germany, and also in the US. And yeah. Thank you so much for your time and your presence and your wisdom.
Well, yeah, okay. It's really nice to see you again, and it's nice to see that you're doing what you're doing. It's great. You're doing a way more than me. You're reaching way more people than I am, so I should be happy to be on your podcast with you. And I am. Take care.
I would love to continue our conversation. Maybe in a few weeks, a month, we can have another talk. I would love that.
Well, just let me know and we'll try to do it again.
Okay. Thank you so much. So thank you everyone listening, and see you next week on the podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Yeah. Thank you so much.